Society doesn't exactly value virtue, does it? If you think about it, our society doesn't applaud virtue. Comedy programs especially are pretty ruthless in the treatment of virtue. And in fact, they set the tone for our attitudes. My family's going to start groaning now because I have a little rant at The Simpsons, but as you're not used to my ranting The Simpsons, it's fine for you to hear it. Whenever we watch The Simpsons, I sit there and I can't help myself because I feel like there's a whole bunch of messages coming through a show like that that people are just taking on board. I mean, one message is that the smartest person in the room is a 10-year-old girl. Having known a few 10-year-old girls, I want to dispute that. Another message is that somebody who's sincere and pleasant and has a living faith in Jesus, like the Ned Flanders character, is naive and repressed. I want to dispute that. Another message is that selfishness and self-centeredness and basically living for pleasure kind of works out in the end. And I want to dispute that. And what I think we regard as entertainment is forming our attitudes, is forming the way we view the world, is determining the parameters that we use to engage with reality. Now, if you're over 50, you might not be as affected as the mass media by some, but there's a whole generation of people who have grown up, and many of them are here this evening, bombarded by the mass media, bombarded by music, bombarded by films and videotapes and games and all of these means by which ideas are formed. Bombarded by messages that come in just when we have no barriers left, just when we're lying on the sofa, just when we're totally receptive. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to live out our lives, but we're living out our lives in ways that are determined by these messages which have impacted our lives. So, for instance, morality becomes something that is not to do with some kind of external set of rules, but morality is something that I make up myself according to what works for me. So we're living in a generation where maybe sexually there are very few limits. The abuse of alcohol and drugs is kind of a victimless crime. But if you put your recycling in the black bin, you're a bad, bad person. Isn't that right? You stick that can in the black bin, you better watch out. They're on you. And that 30-pound steak I'm ordering, it better be sourced locally. It better just come from Devon or somewhere. And it had better been grown up with all the lovely badgers, you know, playing. Do you know what I mean? And it's still a form of morality, isn't it? It's still a set of rules. But it's a morality that doesn't challenge arrogance or pride. It's a morality that does not deal with our hearts. So it is a morality, but it is not virtue. It is morality, but it is not virtue. And you could almost say it's a secular form of legalism. And what we're doing today in our society is that we've set aside characteristics and values that for thousands of years have been regarded as virtues, have been regarded as things to be. And we're replacing them with things that we're told ought to matter. And we kind of think, oh yeah, okay, someone's told us this thing should matter, and we're replacing those timeless virtues with those kinds of things. But here's the problem. If you laugh at a classic understanding of virtue, if you make it something that people make up or pervert or distort or invert as they wish, then don't be surprised if people behave in a way which is self-serving and arrogant and destructive. If we remove virtue from being valuable, then what happens is we end up being shocked when people are cynical and arrogant and self-serving. So let me give you an example. We worship celebrities, and we let them get away with murder, in many cases literally, and then we throw up our hands when it comes out that DJs are sexual predators. We celebrate wealth and extravagance and greed. And then we're disgusted when bankers ruin our economy. We don't give kids any boundaries, and then we're horrified when they burn down the neighborhood. 50 years ago, in an important essay called The Abolition of Man, C.S. Lewis highlighted this very situation. And some of the language is a bit archaic. I'm going to walk you through it, but I think it's worth the effort. He says, in a sort of ghastly simplicity, We remove the organ and demand the function. By that he means that we remove, it's like removing the heart and expecting blood to circulate. Do you get it? We remove the organ but still demand the function. And he says we make men without chests, and we discourage people who are from being honorable and courageous. So he says we make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate and bid the geldings be fruitful. What I want to propose to you just for a couple of minutes this evening is that who you are, the person you are developing into, is crucial. Crucial. Crucial for those who love you, crucial for you, crucial for your community, and crucial for our society. It will literally be the difference between joyful fruitfulness and blessing and a life blighted by destruction and failure. Who you are as a person actually is that important. Who you are as a person and the virtues that you live by and the virtues that you choose not to live by will actually determine the success and the joy of your life, or they will determine the utter failure of many of your endeavors, if not all of your endeavors. The Bible has no confusion about this. In Galatians 5, Paul talks about the acts of the flesh and the life of the spirit. And he uses very stark language. And I don't know if you've ever seen two dogs fighting. Two dogs fighting is a very interesting situation. That what they do is they dig their teeth into each other's flanks, don't they? Have you ever seen this? And they bite into the flank of the other dog, and they end up spinning round and round and round. And what you hear is, rah, 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 rah. And you see these teeth in the flanks of each of the dogs, and they just spin around and round and round in a circle. And Paul says that people can be like that. He says, if you bite, and this is Galatians 5, if you bite and devour each other, watch out, or you'll be destroyed by each other. The acts of the flesh are obvious. Sexual immorality, impurity, debauchery, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, discord, jealousy, fits of rage, selfish ambition, dissensions, factions, envy, drunkenness, orgies, and the like. And I warn you, as I did before, that those who live like this will not inherit the kingdom of God. He says there's a way of living your life which is controlled by desires for sexual conquest or the need for applause, and takes people into an oblivion of drugs and alcohol and a worship of things, and takes you eventually to situations where you are like those two dogs. You're in situations, and I've been in these situations, you're in a situation where you are basically devouring somebody whilst they devour you. And you can laugh at virtue, you can laugh at morality, but people who laugh at virtue and sow a mockery of morality reap a society and a life which is destructive in every way. Paul says that Jesus didn't just come to save us from the hell of afterlife, but from the hell that we're creating here and now. He faced the punishment for that hell on the cross, and he rose in the power of the Spirit. And the key idea here is that the power of the Spirit. And he rose in the Spirit's power. He returned to heaven, and he promised to send the Spirit on everybody who puts their trust in him. And when the Holy Spirit comes on your life, it starts to change you. And if the Holy Spirit hasn't changed you, not it, he starts to change you. And if he hasn't started to change you, then that's a problem. If the Holy Spirit has not started to transform your life, then that's a big problem. A big problem. Look at Galatians 1. I'm just going to pull some ideas out. He says it was for freedom that Christ has set us free. He says, walk by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh. For the flesh desires what is contrary to the Spirit, and the Spirit what is contrary to the flesh. They are in conflict with each other, so that you do not do whatever you want. But if you're led by the Spirit, you're not under the law. And then in the end he says, keep in step with the Spirit. And he says, what happens is, when God's Spirit comes into your life, he starts to create virtues in your life, ethical qualities, behavior patterns, attitudes, and you start to look like a different person. And you have love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness and faithfulness and gentleness and self-control. And all of these qualities start to emerge in your life. And you are start to become a different person in real time, if you like, in real life. And you can understand, can't you, that if we have a society full of people who look like this, you're going to have a pretty great society. If you have a community full of people who look like this, you're going to have a wonderful community. If you have a home and a family full of people who look like this, it's going to be healthy for everybody. It's going to be a blessing for everybody. But for us as individuals, it determines, I don't want to say success, but it determines a life which is fruitful and joyful and productive, rather than a life which gradually takes us more and more into destruction and emptiness away from Jesus. Now, this is quite a long preamble. I want to apologize for that. But I do feel it's important for us to just, every now and then, keep stepping back in this series and understanding what all of these things are about. And tonight we're looking at kindness. When in August, this preaching schedule came out. And I was in Brazil, and it came on my computer. I tapped it open, and I thought, he's having a laugh. He is having a laugh. I'm convinced that when I'm preaching, Simon chooses the messages so that I'll preach on something I need to learn. I hate to break it to you. I think he has a sense of humor, at least in my case. I'm sure nobody else's case. Because he knows that I find kindness difficult, that I'm not a naturally kind person. He, on the other hand, and I'm speaking sincerely, is one of the most kind, redemptive people I've ever met. He really is. But he's working with somebody who isn't very kind. So he works pretty hard with me. And I guess he's giving me this talk tonight. So, if you feel like I'm having a go at you, understand I'm having a go at me. And if you think I'm preaching at you, understand I'm preaching to me. Because this is stuff I need to learn. I thought also this evening we could just very quickly draw a thick line maybe through three of the fruits of the Spirit which are can be confused. The first is kindness and then goodness and gentleness. And I just very quickly want to do that. Kindness, chestatis, I hope. kindness really, the word chestatis just means like to be good-natured and gentle. The opposite is to cut something short. Cut something quickly. The words are used in Luke 5:39. And in Luke 5:39, it's used to talk about a bottle of wine. And the bottle of wine is not a £5.99 bottle of wine from Tesco's. It's a 100-pound bottle of wine that you buy in Tuscany. Okay? It's one of those bottles of wine that when you taste it, is full and rich and has a wonderful aroma. Spiros Zodiatis, a Greek scholar, says that kindness is a grace which pervades the whole nature, mellowing all that which would have been harsh and austere. A grace which pervades your whole nature, mellowing that which would be harsh and austere. And this is good news for people like me, because kindness is not the same as being laid back. There are people even in this room who are terribly laid back, and you're lovely people, and that is a form of kindness, I get that. But the spiritual notion of kindness is not laid backness. Spiritual kindness is the transformation of somebody who is not kind and gentle into somebody who is kind and gentle. The next fruit is goodness. And goodness, as Jason is going to help us next week to understand, is a different again. Goodness is is being able to speak to people and to respond to people in a way which challenges them in a loving way. You can be kind, but not good. If you're kind, that means that you're welcoming people, but not necessarily challenging them. If you're good, it means that you're kind, but you're also, you know, challenging them when they need it. And the final one is gentleness, which could be translated as meekness. And that's kind of more of a strength under control. That's a peace of heart and mind in God's respect. Now, Kensington could not be described as a liberal church, okay? If you're here this evening, that might be news for you, but I doubt it. We are a church that believe that every comma of the Bible is true, and that the Bible is more true than any proposition that our society can come up with. We believe that the Bible stands over every attitude, over every emotion, over every behavior pattern. And that is correct. I would not be standing here if I didn't wholeheartedly, with all my heart, believe that. And yet our theology can become distorted. And our theology can be used as a basis, not for humble thanksgiving, but to fuel pride, to fuel harshness, and to make us pretty rough. And you know, sometimes we can be accused, even at Kensington, of lacking in kindness. Lacking in kindness. A warmth which not only welcomes people, but values them regardless of where they come from. Welcoming people in your heart, and not regarding them as, and this welcome, even the welcome, a warm welcome can be unkind. Because if you're welcoming somebody, but in your heart you're saying, okay, you're defective, but I'm complete, that's not kindness. A kindness is a welcoming towards people which makes them understand that they're completely accepted in a way which is not in any way patronizing. Mary Angelou says, I've learned that people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. And that's true for negative and positive, isn't it? I've learned that people will forget what you said, they will forget what you did, but they will never forget how you made them feel. And you can be right as you like and still make people feel rubbish. You can be theologically precise, but if you're lacking in kindness, you have missed the point. Kindness is a fundamental characteristic that we as a church want to exhibit when someone walks through that door, when someone walks into our life. Responding to people with kindness and acceptance and an interest in them personally is a sign that you know that the Prince of Peace is living in you. Kindness is not the only response we want to offer people, but it's the first response we want to offer people. It's not the only thing we want to say to people, but it's the very first thing we want to say to people. It's the first thing we want people to feel when they come into contact with us. A genuine attitude of care and respect and interest, which gives people confidence and bestows on them value, eye contact, and a controlling in our mind of saying, how am I viewing this person? Am I in some way looking down on them? Or am I saying, I'm so glad to know you. I'm so glad to meet you. Kindness is about warmth. Kindness is about being that 100-pound bottle of wine, that when people taste us, it tastes good. It tastes full. It tastes pleasing. But kindness comes into its own in one special situation that I want to focus down in tonight. I just want to drill down for a few more minutes on where kindness really comes into its own. And here I want us to read another passage. And I'm going to read the passage for you, but it's going to come on the screen as well. Matthew 18, 21 to 35. And this is a story about kindness. Therefore, okay, verse 23 to 35. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. As he began the settlement, a man who owed him 10,000 bags of gold was brought to him. Since he was not able to pay, the master ordered that he and his wife and his children and all that he had be sold to repay the debt. At this, the servant fell on his knees before him and said, "Be patient with me," he begged, "and I'll pay back everything." And the servant's master took pity on him and canceled the debt and let him go. But when the servant went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 silver coins. And he grabbed him and began to choke him. "Pay back what you owe me," he demanded. His fellow servant fell to his knees and begged him, "Be patient with me and I'll pay it back." But he refused. Instead, he went off and had the man thrown into prison until he could pay the debt. And when the other servants saw what happened, they were outraged, and they went and told the master everything that had happened. And then the master called the servant in and said, "You wicked servant," he said, "I canceled all that debt of yours because you begged me to. Shouldn't you have had mercy on your fellow servant, just as I have had on you?" And in anger, his master handed him over to the jailers to be tortured until he should pay back all he owed. And this is how my heavenly Father will treat each of you, unless you forgive your brother and sister from the heart. Now, we could spend another hour exegesis. I'm not going to do that. We could spend a long time looking at this passage, and we should be going through it, verse by verse, and looking at the context and everything. But actually, what I want to do, just for a few minutes at the end, is pull out five principles of how kindness works in this situation that we can just understand a little bit about how kindness works. And there's lots of things we can learn. One of them is that human kindness has limits. Human kindness has limits. Let's think about the servant for a minute. The servant is a normal guy. Nowhere are we told that he's a bad man. And in a normal course of events, he would have been fine with people. He would have been fine with the other guy who owed him money. In fact, he'd lent the guy money. He must have been a fairly good guy. He'd lend the guy 100 coins, 100 silver coins. And yet, at this point, he's asked and asked and asked, and the man has kind of prevaricated and prevaricated and said, yeah, later, later, later. And so now he's lost it. And he grabs the man and chokes him. He's come to the end of his limit. And what we want to see here is that human kindness is not enough. People say that, you know, there are lots of people who are kind. And they're kind when you agree with them. And they're kind when you do what they say. And they're kind in accepting when it doesn't cost them anything. And that form of kindness is basically one step away from courtesy, common courtesy. But with those people, if you offend them, if you tell them something you don't want to hear, they don't want to hear, they can turn on you. If you disagree with them, they'll come after you. And if you hurt them, they won't rest till you're destroyed. I once had a man who had been a friend from Sardinia. Island people can be a little bit exciting at times, especially those in the Mediterranean. And he once told me that in their town in Sardinia, they had a metal door. Sardinia, you know, is an island off the coast of Italy. I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page with that. And in the town there, they had this metal door. And every year on a special saint's day, they would have a competition in the town. Get this. Every man in the town would headbutt the door until they knocked it down. And these guys are there, I'm sure to this day, whacking a metal door with their heads. And their heads are bleeding, 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 and they're being knocked out left, right, and center. But they're still headbutting this metal door until they knock it down. I had the unfortunate situation to get that person angry at me. And that was a rough time. That was a rough time. And people will be kind until you do something to offend them. And then there won't be any kind of barrier to their anger. Don't get mad, get even. You bring down my twin towers, I'll come to your country and I'll blast you into the Stone Age. See how that works? People talk about the Old Testament as if it was primitive. And they say, look at the Old Testament, an eye for eye and tooth for tooth. That's terrible, isn't it? Eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But what they don't understand is in a world without police and in a world without law and in a world without central authority, if you offend me or if you do something to hurt me, I will leave my compound with my guys and I'll come to your compound and I will kill your family in front of you. And then I'll kill you, and then I'll kill all your cousins, just to make sure no one comes after me. This is human nature. Human nature is not saying, oh, well, you offended me this little bit, so I'm going to just come back to you with that little bit. Human nature is, you offend me this little bit, I'm going to destroy you. So in a world without kind of law courts and central authority, they said, okay, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. If someone takes your eye, you cannot take more than their eye. If someone takes your tooth, you cannot take more than their tooth. And actually, it was kindness. It was a form of kindness. And our natural response is to loathe and hate and criticize and undermine and destroy people who offend us. And we are like two dogs spinning around, spinning around. And the story is telling us that heavenly kindness is limitless. The kindness of God is limitless. And here God forgives this massive debt, a debt that no one could ever forgive. No one, who could afford to write off a debt that big? But God forgives it. But then the servant doesn't forgive, and he chokes his other servant. And the servants who are watching, the people who are watching, come to the master and they say, you know what, look what happened. There should be some kind of justice here. There should be some kind of response. And the central core to this story is if you receive kindness, you will show kindness. If you receive kindness, you will show kindness. Not only when you welcome people in the general course of events, but especially when someone offends you, when someone hurts you, you're going to choose not to get your own back, but you're going to choose to respond in a way which is warm and caring and loving, not just coldly polite, but warmly loving. And embedded in these words is an understanding that when someone comes to us and hurts us, the spiritual gift of kindness, the spiritual fruit of kindness, means that we respond back to them with a warmth as if they had never done it. Now, for me, this is a huge challenge. Because if people offend me, I have a strategy. I'll admit it to you right now. I just pull away. I don't go at them. I don't shout at them. They stop existing for me. They just stop existing. And as I read this story, what I hear God saying to me is, Mark, you can't do that anymore. When someone offends you, you have to respond to them with the same level of warmth as you always did, as if they'd never offended you. And the story is telling us that the other servants and the master himself are saying, this is what has to happen. And that's what God is like. That's the way God behaves. Jesus is in the garden. They're ripping him. They're dragging him. And Peter gets a sword and cuts somebody's ear off. What does Jesus do? He picks the sword up of the guy who's had his hands on him and puts his ear back on. He's on the cross and he's hanging there. And the two guys either side are laughing at him and jibing at him. And then a minute later, he's turning to one of them and saying, today you're going to be with me in paradise. And we are these people, aren't we? We're those people. That's the way we are. That's the way I am. We are people who are like the dogs, spinning around, biting and devouring. Or if we're not doing that, we're treating people as if they're just not, you know, yeah, you're not really quite right. There's something wrong with you. I'm better than you. Or where there's people who are impure or debauched and idolaters, and we practice a form of witchcraft. We're consumed with jealousy and rage and selfish. We form groups and we have dissension and factions and gossip. That's who we are. But ultimately, the kindness of God has shown us that even though these offenses were first and foremost against him, he became the one who hung on the cross and bore the penalty for our sin. Not only did he respond with kindness to us, but his kindness was so powerful, he identified with us in a complete way, so powerfully that our sin became his. And God put on Jesus, his son, the penalty for our sin, and punished Jesus. And those who have offended him receive from him such a great gift of love that his own son died. Neil Todman is one of my mentors, and every time I see Neil, I always take a notebook, because boy, just every word that drips out of his mouth, I'm there writing it down. All my best sermon illustrations, they're Neil's. They're just Neil's. And last time I saw him, he was talking about a situation in his church where he'd been profoundly offended. Profoundly offended. And he said to me, you know what? But it just reminds me that every time I come to God and I say, oh Lord, I've done it again. I've committed that sin again. I've said that thing again. I've done that thing again. God turns to me and says, what sin? Because God has the capacity, the choice to forget. God can actually choose to forget, so that when we sin and we ask for forgiveness, he chooses to forget that we ever did that. So every time we come back to him, we say, I'm sorry I did it again. He says, you did what again? Can you see the kindness? Can you see the kindness in the love of God? And that just brings us very quickly to the end. Why should I be kind? This story tells us about why we should be kind. Well, firstly, you know, because this is now who we are. It's the fruit of the Spirit. God puts kindness into us, but we respond by what he's done with us by choosing to be kind. And there are just three real reasons why I think we need to be kind. The first is this: I've been forgiven a greater offense. The servant had been forgiven millions, and he was angry about hundreds. He'd been forgiven a massive offense. And we've already seen, haven't we, that every time we come to God, we say, okay, God, I've done it again and again. And he says, done what? And we ourselves have been forgiven an offense that we cannot begin to understand. And that teaches us, doesn't it, to offer kindness to people who offend us. When I see how much God has forgiven me, the natural logic dictates that I respond with the same way to other people. And furthermore, if I respond with kindness to people, that demonstrates that I understand that I am forgiven. And if I cannot respond with kindness to people, then I have to ask myself, have I ever understood what it means to be forgiven at all? Or have I actually been forgiven at all? Secondly, we can be kind because we have everything in Him. The servant had received a reinstatement. The servant was on his way to jail, and he was not only forgiven of his debt, but he was reinstated in his post. He was provided with security, not only for him, but for his whole family. And having received the forgiveness of God, we have all that we need. We have the luxury of responding with others with kindness. He has forgiven us everything. He is preparing a home for us. When we come to him and say, I'm sorry, I did it again, he says, I don't know what you're talking about. Do you understand that when you have that, you have the luxury of responding to others with kindness? See, the reason why we get angry with people is because we have expectations of them. We expect something from them. The reason why we get angry with them, this is why we get angry with the people we love much more than people that we don't love, because we have higher sets expectations. But if all your expectations are already fulfilled because Jesus has given you everything in heaven, then your expectations of other people are diminished. And when they fail against you, you have the luxury of saying, well, come back. Come and have a hug. Let's start again. Because you're not hoping for anything from them. You're not expecting anything from them. You have been made complete in Christ. But the third reason why we can forgive is because no one owes us anything. The word servant here, you know what that word is? Doulos. It means indentured slave. Indentured slave. Somebody who's paying off slavery, who's a slave of the master. And my identity is that I am a servant and I live and work amongst other servants. I am a slave and I live and work amongst other slaves. And nobody owes me anything. No one owes me respect. No one owes me a pat on the back. No one owes me anything. I have no rights. This morning, Simon shared this, and I want to share it with you. He shared just a quote from George Mueller, which I thought was really powerful. He said, Mueller said, the turning point of his life was when he said this to himself. He said, there was a day when I died, utterly died. Died to George Mueller, his opinions, preferences, tastes, and will. Died to the world, its approval or censure. Died to the approval or blame, even of my brothers and friends. And since then, I have only shown myself to be approved by God. Jesus had all of these rights, but he gave them up to be a servant. And you and I are, if we love him, we are servants of his, we are slaves of his, and no one owes us absolutely anything. No one owes us anything. And what happens is, when you understand that no one owes you anything, then when they offend you, it just kind of falls away, or it can start falling away. We've just seen that God forgives and forgets, truly forgets. And forgetfulness is a part of this, isn't it? We choose to forget past offenses. But more importantly, maybe, we choose to forget ourselves. We choose to forget ourselves. And once we grasp these truths, we can start to become impervious to offense. Does it hurt when people are mean to you? Of course it hurts. But it doesn't hurt for so long. And it's something we can shake off. And we can choose not to prolong the pain. And resentment and hatred no longer seem like the right response. But instead, kindness becomes our choice. Kindness to those who are kind to us. Kindness to those who disagree with us. Kindness to those who hurt us. Kindness. What we're going to do in a few minutes is just have one final song, and then we just want to give people a chance to respond. The band will keep on playing. We won't have a kind of proper close or a formal close to the service. And we want to maybe encourage you to pray with somebody. You know, if you're sitting next to somebody you'd like to pray with them, just pray with them. And maybe you can ask yourself this question: have I ever experienced this kind of kindness in my life? I know about Jesus, but have I ever experienced this kindness in my life? And if you feel you have, then maybe you can start praying about some of those areas in your life where you need to be showing that kindness.